Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Deborah Copagan-Cogan. She joins us by telephone from somewhere out east, New York?
I'm in, actually, Harlem, New York. Yeah, I live up in Harlem.
I wanted to have you on the program because you just wrote a piece that was just published in The Nation magazine that is really an interesting piece, and I wanted to talk to you about it and find out more about it and why you decided to write it, because as you mention in the piece, you refer to this as career suicide.
Yeah, I was I was actually kind of surprised by the reaction, because I really was nervous about it, but I also just thought, at this point in my career, you know, I've been working for 25 years, I truly had nothing to lose, because the situation just seemed, every book that came out, there was some sort of insult in some way that seemed to be endemic. And I guess, how did it start? It started because, I'm trying to think exactly how it started. It sort of had a bunch of different starts. I was at a lean-in book party for Sheryl Sandberg. And Sheryl had reached out to me after I published a piece in Slate about Kawasaki disease. My son had been diagnosed with Kawasaki disease, which is a disease of the heart. And he had been diagnosed on Facebook because I couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. They just had a, what is that show by Shonda Rhimes? They just had a Grey's Anatomy on this topic. And it's one of the hardest diseases to diagnose. And I put a picture of my son on Facebook, and a pediatric cardiologist and a friend and another pediatrician had seen these photos and said, you know, I see that you can't figure out what's wrong with your son. Have you thought about Kawasaki disease? And in fact, that's what it was. And with Kawasaki disease, you have to get diagnosed within 5 days, or the heart damage can become lethal. So I had written this piece for Slate, and Sheryl actually reached out via email and said, we loved your piece, thank you for publishing it. And then when she had her lean-in book party, I was invited to the lean-in book party. And I was telling her, I said, this is so great that you're getting all this attention for this book. It's wonderful. It's an important message. It needs to be said. I just wanted you to know, though, that in book publishing, leaning in is very hard. And women don't usually get the same amount of coverage, especially for fiction. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, let me just forward you an email that I sent to the New York Times Book Review, telling them that they had not written reviews of any of my four books, although they'd been well reviewed, you know, by industry people, like, you know, Starred Review and Publishers Weekly, all those things that you assume would lead up to at least a review in the New York Times Book Review. And I sent her this letter, and she said, I can't believe it. She was sort of shocked by the fact that women's fiction and women's writing in general was taken less seriously than men's writing. So that was sort of the backstory. And I'm sorry it took me so long to explain that. But the real spark for the piece happened when I was on spring break with my kids. I'm at my mom's house, and it's 5 in the morning, and I'm awake. And I am looking at the obituary for Yvonne Brill. Now, Yvonne Brill was a famous rocket scientist. I believe, I don't remember exactly, but I believe she's the reason that our satellites stay in orbit. And her obituary led with, she made a mean beef stroganoff, followed her husband from city to city. I don't remember the exact wording, but I just thought, I cannot believe that a female rocket scientist has to put up with this stuff. And it brought back these incredible feelings of, well, let's just call it what it was, anger over the fact that when my first book, Shutterbait, came out, every single reviewer, not every single one, but almost every single reviewer referred to me as a stay-at-home mother. And I thought, in what world would a male author ever in a book review be referred to as a stay-at-home father? And then it just kind of went from there. I sat down at my computer. I mean, not sat down. I was in bed, and I opened the laptop, and pounded out these 2,500 words in lightning speed. I've never written so fast. Mm. And I just thought, I'm not going to write a polemic here. There's no point in polemic. What I want to do is just write year by year these various tiny little insults, which add up to sexism, sort of ad hominem attacks, being called a stay-at-home mother, the slut-shaming of a review in Salon, where essentially the review was not really a review of the book at all, but a screed against my sexual habits. And the point of Shutter Babe, when I had written it, was to write a book that showed that all human beings who are journalists are also human beings. And the idea was to name each chapter after a particular man in my life. Three of them were boyfriends, one was a friend, one was my husband, and the final one was my son. And I just wanted to show sort of a journey of coming of age, and to explain that even though each chapter was really about the war that I was covering at the time, so the first chapter was Afghanistan, the fourth chapter, I believe, was about the fall of the Soviet Union. No, the fourth chapter was about Romania. The fifth chapter was about the fall of the Soviet Union. Anyway, each chapter was really about a war or a story that I'd covered. But while I was covering that story, I was also a human being living a life, and there were other human beings involved. And I thought that it was important for a journalist to explain, I'm not just an automaton. I'm not just a robot out there in the world covering these stories. I'm a person, and I was growing up. I was 22 years old when I first started covering wars, and that was definitely a part of my story that I wanted to include in the memoir, and I was roundly vilified for this. I believe I sent you some of the quotes.
Deborah Copagan-Kogan joins us. It should be noted that book, Shutter Babe, you were a war photographer, and the title was not your choice.
No, I sold the book under the title News Whore, which people find offensive as well, but I chose that title because it's something that journalists sometimes call each other, news whores. You know, it's an obvious insult, and it's sort of this kind of black comedic way of referring to one another. I chose that title because I wanted to reclaim the word whore. I knew that writing about my personal life along with my professional life was risky. Nobody had done it before. And I wanted to just put it out there from the start. I know what you're going to say about me. I know what you're going to call me. And I'm going to call myself that first. And therefore, in the same way that gays sort of took over the word gay, I wanted to take over that word whore and lessen the impact of it and say, I'm in on this, guys. I know that this is what we're talking about, and I know what you're going to call me. And yet when the publisher put it out there, they said they wanted to call it Shutter Babe, but they didn't want to publish it under News Whore. They said they couldn't put whore on a book. And I said, okay, well, what other titles? So we had days and days and days of choosing titles, and a friend of mine had come up with Shutter Babe, and so I included that on a list of titles, which was my fault. I shouldn't have included it if I didn't like it. But I put it next to Shutter Babe and Shutter Girl, and I said I preferred Shutter Girl, but I understood that Shutter Bug and Shutter Babe are more closely related. And they said, no, that's the title we want. And then I thought about it, and I realized I don't want to call myself Babe. That's absolutely the wrong title. And I said, no, you know what? I'm very uncomfortable with Babe. I don't want to refer to my looks at all. It's not what this book is about. In fact, this book is sort of let me think how I want to phrase this. It's about how one is often judged on one's looks. And I don't want to put the word babe in the title. So I tried to change the title to either Shutter Girl, or I thought even better would be Develop, Stop, Fix, which are the various baths of in the black and white darkroom. So develop that. You put the piece of paper in, and you start to see the picture. In the stop app, it stops the action so that you're keeping it at a specific point. And then the fix is when you fix it in time and fix the image forever. And I thought, because I had divided the book into those three sections, develop was the beginning, stop was the middle, and fix was the end, it would sort of be a perfect title. And I said, oh, you know, three verbs, it'll never fly. And this was, you know, of course, before Eat, Pray, Love had ever come out. Mm-hmm. And I was fighting hard for develop, stop, fix. I was willing to go with Shutter Girl, and I had a... I remember the conversation so well. I was standing on a street corner on my cell phone, talking with the publisher, saying, I'm really, really uncomfortable with Shutter Babe. I really don't want to choose that title. It makes me incredibly uncomfortable. And she said, we've got your back. Don't worry. It's a great title. People will love it. And I was told that that was the decision. I could not change the title. Mm-hmm. And everything I feared about that title came true.
And you were stuck.
And I was stuck. The battle that I did win was... The original cover they had shown me was a cartoon figure, a cartoon human figure, female, with the camera covering the genitalia. And I said, you know, it's usually my eye behind the camera, not my vagina. Mm. And I really am offended by that cover. I don't want that cover going out there. And they said, well, we don't have time. We don't have the resources to change the cover. And I said, you have the resources because you have me, and I'm a photographer, and I'll shoot something. And I'll shoot it gratis, and I'll figure out a better cover. Why don't I shoot myself in a mirror so you just have my eye and the camera, and that would be the cover. And they agreed to that, thank goodness, because I really like, you know, that part of the book I was happy with. I enjoyed what they did with the cover in terms of the layout and the art of it. But the title drove me crazy. But I have not been able to title three of my books. I have four books, and three of them I have not been able to create the title. So my second book was called Suicide Wood. It was an allegory of Dante's Inferno, a modern-day allegory, with a based on a true story, actually, of a my friend growing up. When I was 6 years old, my friend in school had disappeared, and I had no idea what had happened to her. And it turns out her mother had taken her and her siblings into a car and fed the exhaust into the car and killed herself and the children. Mm. And so I wanted to write a novel about that, about a journalist trying to figure out what happened to her friend years ago. And the way I was seeing the novel in my head was basically a journey down into hell. And I thought, oh, that's a great structure. Why don't I just take Dante's Inferno, choose the same structure so that each circle of hell that she goes down will have some sort of various modern-day equivalent. And I'll call it Suicide Wood because one of the circles is the Wood of the Suicides. It's a good title. And I sold it on the basis of that title. But when it came time to publish it, they said, you know, titles with suicide in them never sell. And I said, but what about Jeff Eugenides has that great book, one of my favorite books, The Virgin Suicide. Virgin Suicide, sorry. And they said, well, that title has virgin in it.
And you've made this transition to writing novels, and your most recent one is coming out in paperback here in a couple of weeks. It's The Red Book, and you've been nominated for Britain's Women's Prize for Fiction, formerly known as the Orange Prize. This should be really great, right?
Right. Yes, it should be great, and yet, here's the wonderful thing about the nomination is that it gave me the courage to write this piece. Meaning, if I hadn't been nominated for a prize, as silly as prizes are, I understand that it's, you know, it's all kind of silly, but at the same time, a prize confers a certain judgment, and the judgment is this is worth reading. And so it made me feel that I could finally speak out and say, hey, you know, this book that was nominated for the Women's Prize for Fiction was not even reviewed in my hometown paper, the New York Times, and neither were any of the others. And the VITA statistics that have come out over the past 4 years, I mean, I think that VITA has done an amazing job of just documenting the number of books by women reviewed versus the number of books by men reviewed. And if you take a look at the statistics, maybe you could put it on a website or something so people could see, it's clear as day when you see the pie charts. You know, men's books get far more coverage than women's books, and there are far more male reviewers than there are female reviewers. So men are still the arbiters of taste. And so it just, it felt like the right moment. You know, I've been a professional woman in various careers. I was a war photographer, then I was a TV news producer, then I was a memoirist, journalist, and now novelist. And in each of those incarnations in my life, I've had to deal with sexism. And I just thought that taken as a whole would sort of be interesting to look back on the various moments when these things had occurred.
And from my experience working with books and talking to authors for a number of years, women are reading the books. It's men do read, but women read a lot more than men. And so you have men who are the arbiters of taste, as you have pointed out from these statistics, who are writing the reviews, who are reviewing books by other men. And yet women are the ones who devour the books. They're doing all the reading.
Exactly. And yet women are very highly influenced by the reviews, as we all are. Women and men, you know, you read a review where someone is vilified. You know, I pulled some of this stuff out here. One review of Shutterbait, for example, says, "I ask her if she's worried her frankness will get her labeled a slut." Well, that's an interesting question to ask, but I asked her not to print it because I thought that asking me if I was worried about being called a slut was basically the passive-aggressive equivalent of calling me a slut. Another review said, "Kogan, who finally abandoned her wicked, wicked ways, is now happily married with two children in New York City." Well, what wicked, wicked ways? Are we calling, you know, being sexually active wicked? I mean, these are reviews in newspapers that get published, and then that influences those who read these reviews. And I sound frustrated, it's because I am. It's just frustrating. So, in fact, going back into the folder with all these sort of nasty screeds was frustrating in and of itself and made me feel all over again this kind of pain. I mean, a true pain in my heart reading about the vilification of women and the vilification of females who dare to speak out about sexuality.
And the frustration that you expressed walking into bookstores and wanting to sign copies of your books and having the clerk go, never heard of that one. Was it reviewed in the New York Times? We wouldn't carry it if it wasn't. Was it Sam Tannenhaus that you emailed?
Yes, it was Sam Tannenhaus that I emailed. And let me just say on the record, he wrote a very gracious, lovely email back where he seemed genuinely contrite about this, but it didn't mean that the book ever got reviewed. It was just a lovely, contrite email that didn't change anything. And that day at those bookstores, you know, I drive a Vespa around New York just basically to save money and for convenience sake. And so I hopped on the Vespa. The book had just hit in the New York Times bestseller list. And I thought, all right, I really should take a day out of my writing time to jump on the Vespa and go to these various bookstores and sign stock, because it's helpful to the bookstores when you do that. Mm-hmm. It's easier to sell a book that's a signed copy, and it's a good way of promoting a book. And I went to four independent booksellers in New York City, and none of them had stocked them. And one of them actually had said, you know, we wanted to get that book. I don't know what happened. We meant to get that book.
Mm.
So when you don't have coverage in the New York Times to sort of remind, especially independent booksellers, which really are the ones that are the hand sellers. You know, a good independent bookseller is a reader's best friend because they read everything, they hear about everything, and they will put a book in the hands of a reader saying, you should read this.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't have your books in those stores and you don't have that bookseller to reader interaction, it just doesn't happen because there's no book to sell.
And it should have been fun. You should have been hopping on your Vespa and going around and finding your book in all these stores and signing them and feeling good about the whole process. And instead, you were crushed.
Yeah, but, you know, I think every writer is used to that at a certain level, too. You know, that's not necessarily specific to my case, but it really, the fact that it had hit the New York Times bestseller list that week that I jumped on the Vespa and went around to sign stock and then had to come home with this pristine Sharpie that had never signed a single book, you know,
yeah,
we all face various humiliations in our life. But this, it's like, okay, it's Monday, just another day of humiliation here.
Yeah. My guest on the program is Deborah Copagan, and I was nervous that maybe we wouldn't be able to fill a whole program talking about this article that you wrote for The Nation, but by golly, we could probably do two programs.
Well, let's keep talking. Are we done already?
No, we're still recording this for AirPlay here, and you have quite a story in this article. It just appeared in The Nation magazine, and you were, I hate to use the cliche, venting some spleen, but you were calling it the way you feel it. And
here's the thing. My cell phone has an alert every time somebody tweets at me. You know, if they tweet my name, I get a little ding.
Yeah.
And about an hour after the piece went live on the Nation website, I had to figure out how to turn that off because my phone just kept dinging and buzzing and dinging and buzzing. And I went on Twitter and I checked the response, and it actually made me cry. I couldn't believe how many people were responding to this with sort of amen, sister, and yes, this is what I experienced. And how many of those tweets began with, this made me cry. Now, I didn't mean to make anyone cry, but I think what happened is that women in all sorts of careers, not just writers, just women scientists, women business people, women lawyers, women in the world of work read this and they said, yes, this is my story too.
You struck a nerve.
This is exactly what happened to me. The events were different and the details were different, but you were describing my life. And it was so edifying in a certain way. And I guess the best part of this is I was on a college tour with my son. He's gotten into a couple colleges, one of which was Oberlin, and we were in Ohio, in Cleveland, visiting Oberlin. And he saw these texts and these tweets and these, you know, he saw the whole thing unfold. And he looked at me, he said, what have you done? And I said, I don't know what I've done. He said, You've done something really great here, Mom. And I said, I hope so. I don't know. It may mean that we don't have food on our table ever again, but I hope I've done something great. And he looked at me and he grabbed my hand, which he never does. He's a 17-year-old boy. Like, what boy ever grabs his mother's hand? But he grabbed my hand and he said, I'm really proud of you. And, you know, my God, like, that was a special moment.
Well, I read the piece and I said, I've got to have Deborah on the program because
thank you very much.
You know, I thought, you know, this is important for people to hear this. And there's so much more. You need to read the whole piece on Nation because there's so many things that have happened to you, ways that you've been pushed down in your life. And you keep getting back up, don't you?
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was trying to explain is that women are told over and over again, don't speak up. Don't speak up because they will smear you and they will call you crazy and they will drag your name through the mud. And in so many instances, I didn't speak up because I couldn't and I was afraid of being dragged through the mud. And then the times that I did speak up, my name was dragged through the mud, or the times that I tried to be, to say what life was like for me. For example, in Shutter Babe, here is my life as I lived it. And then to be demonized for that just felt horrible. I mean, there were many days after that book came out when I would read these horrible, slut-shaming, nasty pieces of journalism, and I would be curled up in a little ball on my bed just wanting it all to go away. And then after that, I realized, you know what, you can get up, you know, dust yourself off and keep going and keep trying. You know, one of my favorite books when I was growing up, the book that my father read to me every night for, you know, for a year when I was 2 years old, was The Little Engine That Could. I'm 5'2". Sometimes I feel like The Little Engine That Could, and hopefully I'm going to get over that mountain at some point.
Are you working on another novel?
I was up until last week. A few days before I published this piece in The Nation, I started not being able to sleep because I was nervous about it. And I actually had my first night of sleep last night for the first time since last Monday. So it's been stomach churning, and I haven't been able to focus, at least this week, on the novel. But I figure tomorrow, after I had a nice night of sleep last night, hopefully I'll get another one tonight, I'll just sit back down and do the work, because the work is the most important. And I'm also going to try to get this prize off the ground. In fact, I just got an email back from a friend out in San Francisco who has a company in mind, and I won't say anything until it happens, but I want to get a corporate sponsorship, and I just want to get this done. It might not be for another year or two or three or even five. I know that when they started the Orange Prize, it was in reaction to the 1991 Booker Prize, which had all men. And I believe, I hope I get these dates right, I believe that the first Orange Prize was 1996, so it took them 5 years to get that prize off the ground. I'm hoping to get it off the ground sooner than that, but I'm determined to do it.
Wow. Well, good luck with that. It's really been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you so much, Vic. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate you reaching out. It was very kind of you. Thank you.
Our guest has been Deborah Copagan-Cogan. And at this point, if I really had it together, I would cue up Dirty Water by the Standells, but
maybe... I just posted that on Facebook.
Maybe next time.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And when that next novel comes out, we'll have to have you back and have you talk about fiction.
I would love that.
Okay.
Well, it's going to be another 2 years, so don't hold your breath. But in 2 years, I'll give you a call. How about that?
Sounds good. You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Over the past several years, there has been an outpouring of books about the Civil War as we mark the 150th anniversary of that terrible conflict. A number of those books have been about our president, Abraham Lincoln. And one of the leading authorities on Abraham Lincoln is Harold Holzer. He has written over 40 books, and many of them are about Abe Lincoln. Tune in next week when my guest will be Harold Holzer. His new book, The Civil War in 50 Objects, in the Book Nook on WYSO. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.